This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Charles Carriage. Charles is a local California real estate investor, realtor, and broker who has been serving the real estate market for over 43 years. Charles began his journey with Century 21 Masters in Walnut, California, before moving on to South Coast Properties. He was instrumental in building South Hills Properties to one of the leading independent-owned non-franchise firms in Southern California. Charles' knowledge, expertise, and background in the residential resale market is extensive. Long-standing relationships with banks, financial institutions, along with a network of experienced real estate agents have made Charles and South Hills Properties a company well-known for its exemplary service. Charles also believes in giving back through volunteering and financially supporting local and international charities that include Habitat for Humanity, the Sheepfold, and Royal Family Kids, to name a few. Helping others in need is part of his company's heritage and a core pillar. So Charles, we welcome you to our show.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you. Thank you. You aged me a bit. It's actually 33 years. 1988 is when I got into real estate. But
I didn't understand that number myself. When I looked at that, I went, well, what did he do? Start when he was nine?
I like that. Yeah, actually, but 33 years is a long time. Yes, it is.
But it changes something too. So you said, what now, 1988 or 88?
1988, yes. That's okay. When I started into real estate.
Okay, well, that's a big, see, I think there's something about when you get into real estate and what happens, like I got into it in 1981, right at the end of 80. And, you know, interest rates were crazy. They were 17%. And in some ways, it altered my way of thinking about 10% interest rates. You know, if you're a kid and all you've ever seen is four and now they're two and somebody said you're going to see six someday, you know, freak out. For me, that's still a deal.
that's right. And I didn't get to see, I saw the 17 and 18% that my parents had to deal with. But when I did get into the real estate in 1988, we were happy if they were single digits, because at that time we weren't dealing with 17 or 18. But when I first started, I think it might have been, was definitely above single digits, which it had to be around 10 or 11%. So if it was single digit, we were happy.
Yeah, that was celebration time. Now, why real estate? Were your parents in real estate?
Oh, good question. I'm the son of a sewer construction worker, Bruce. And my dad was extremely hard worker. That's where I learned the amazing work ethic. And he never really wanted his boys to, I have an older brother, go into construction. So I was in the labor's union, actually literally a ditch digger for a while, and realized this isn't really what I wanted to do. And then I started doing a little bit of tree service work and had a tree service company. It was students professional tree service that I used to kind of pay my way through junior college. And then, I realized at that point too, it was really difficult work and really dangerous work with the chainsaw, and just felt like that wasn't what I was really wired to do. And through working at one person's home, and then he moved up into this exclusive area in Diamond Bar in the country. And then he said, why are you doing this? Why aren't you in real estate? I actually did get my license in about 83, but only used it for a few months. So I don't even count that point where it just, nothing took off. But he said, I will help you. And he said, gosh, you have your license. People would really wish they had one. You should take off and use yours. And he said, I'll help you, this and that. So I followed up, and through much prayer, it was about maybe a year later, and the tree service just kind of dropped out. The business just went down. And I was left kind of wondering what to do. And I was thinking of going in with another friend's company, who was a huge company in Pomona, Tom Day Tree Service. And he and I had a talk, and he said, Charles, I will hire you. But he said, is this really what you want to do? And he told me kind of the Ben Franklin approach, write down on a piece of paper the pros and cons. And he said, and if you want to do this, then I'll hire you in a minute. And I had a follow-up talk with him or looked at it and realized, gosh, you know what? I really want to work with my mind. I want to do, and it just kind of all aligned with the real estate. And I'll never forget it. And at that point, and I was praying a lot, I'm a Christian, a man of faith, and really believe that God is there and helps guide and direct our life. And I was praying, and I called my friend Rick, the top agent. I didn't even know he was the top agent in at that time in Diamond Bar at the home. And honestly, Bruce, at that time, I didn't even have money for a lockbox. I was the tree dropped out, and I said, Rick, I don't even have money for a lockbox. Oh, you can borrow mine. And I said, Rick, I really don't believe I should be working on Sundays either. I just, that's the time off that I spend at church and with my family, and time to take a break. And I believe that's when how I'm supposed to live. Oh, you'll be fine. Even though he works 7 days a week. In the end, it was amazing, Bruce, because he helped me, and he did. He loaned the lock boxes. He was there. It was amazing. And I will say this. The very first person I told I was in real estate said he wanted to sell his house. And I did. Until the follow-up sequel to this, that it only took me about 200 homes afterwards or 300 to door knock later to find my next listing or months later. But the very first person. So I really felt that confirmation by God for me that I was supposed to be in the real estate. And what an adventure and a ride it's been. And met such amazing people, including you, Bruce, who, as all the audience knows, he's been such a blessing to all of us. And I happened to get to know him in the mid-90s through his California comeback as I was knee deep in the first REO market after all the defense industry cut back. And we had the real estate flat on its heels from about 91 to 97. And that's where I heard Bruce to begin talking about his California comeback, and really been following you ever since. And because of all this great wisdom and information you've shared, that's a huge part of my success. So, and I'm sure for other listeners as well. And for that, we all collectively are very thankful for what you've done for all of us.
Charles, thanks a lot. I appreciate that more than you know. It's been, obviously, it's been the best thing that I ever went, you know, going down a road where you don't even know you're going to head. And that's very interesting. Trying to figure out what's next in California has been turned into a 25-year passion. But maybe as most things started, did by stubbing my toe, you know, building some custom homes when the market was not ready to say you can sell them. You know, 1990 was a bad time to show up with $500,000 houses in Palm Springs.
Right.
So, yeah, learning to survive that. I'm curious, did you have an entrepreneurial bent to you when you were a kid?
Well, that's a really good question. So I grew up, as I mentioned, my dad was in construction, sewer construction, extremely hard worker, 5 a.m, 4:30 a.m, leave for the job, and then come home at 6, always worked. Even rain, my dad would go check on the job. And he wasn't much of an entrepreneur, but we moved from La Mirada to Diamond Bar in 79. And my dad had this idea, let's start a business. So he toyed with two ideas. Either, and back then when I was in high school, and some can relate, maybe if Mike Cantu is listening, he probably could relate. The big thing for us was mopeds. And so my dad, and we had this really extremely successful bike shop in La Mirada, Spence's Bike Shop. And so we thought, well, bike and moped shop or 7-Eleven. And 7-Eleven hadn't been proven yet in the whole area. It was brand new kind of. And so unfortunately, my dad didn't pick 7-Eleven, or I'd probably be the king of 7-Eleven and not on the show right now, Bruce. But instead, we started RMC Mopeds and Bikes, Roy, Mike, and Charlie. And so my dad let my brother and I run it, and we ran it straight into the ground. We didn't know what we were doing. Actually, we were quite successful for a while. Bruce, we would sell mopeds, and at that time, so that was 79 and 80, the moped would cost $500, and I still remember this. And we would finance it, and I think the interest rate to finance through Pook Motor Corporation, Moped Corporation, or Motor Corporation, Pook is made in Germany, $18 a month. They would finance it with just this extremely minimal down payment. I don't remember the length of the loan, but I think the interest rate was 18 a month. And I think it was about, very cheap to finance the moped. And then when Carter cut out the credit, as what you were referring to, the interest rates just, there was no real interest, the ability to be able to finance a small ticket item like that. And when we had to just go for no credit sales, that killed the whole part of it. But that's where I learned from 17 to about 19, the entrepreneurial spirit kind of birthed in me. My brother went into construction. He always wanted to do that, and he's still doing it to this day. It wasn't my dad's heart that either one of us would want to do that, but my brother went that way. But I learned more. I only have my AA degree. I dropped out of college for financial reasons. I didn't have the money to continue to complete it. But I really feel that was an incubator for the entrepreneurial spirit of having that moped shop. And my dad had to keep his regular job. And here's an amazing thing, Bruce. This is no pressure to put on your 17 and 18 and a half year old brother. My dad took a second out on his house at Diamond Bar. And I think at that time in 79, it was about a 10 or 20% of the value of the home of the second, which was about $20,000 on $100,000. So $20,000 second. And he told my brother and I, by the way, boys, if this doesn't make it, we lose the house. No pressure to put on us. But the good news is they didn't lose the house. And we did lose the business. We closed the business. But I learned a lot. And it really birthed the entrepreneurial spirit of just having the freedom and the flexibility and the time. And when I went to Mount SAC, I remember, and I was taking principles of real estate, Mr. Names, the junior college professor, used to talk about the freedom of real estate, that he could go to his kids' games and he could do these other different things. So maybe I was never wired for corporate America. We've done a lot as a vendor for them, working in the world of corporate America, but on the side of taking care of the asset management piece for them, but never working inside. I've been self-employed really for, pretty much all my life, ever almost since I've been 18, just about.
Yeah. Now, when you got into real estate, you're at, if it's 88, you've got two really great years of inflation of real estate prices. And that, you know, in the mindset of somebody in California, hey, that's kind of normal. Things go up. It always does well. And then all of a sudden, and for the first time in 1990, through a very long stretch, the whole game changes. So you're kind of at the beginning of that. You know, you only have a couple of years experience. Could you see, okay, I've got to change who my client is? Because that's basically, if you're an REO agent, you're doing something that's not, there's not a blueprint in 1990 for that.
No, that really good point, Bruce. You're right. In 88, it was go, gangbusters. Prices were going up, and it lasted for about 2 years. And then we hit Desert Storm, the first Desert Storm. And then with the aerospace industry, it all dropped out. And I used to door knock. I used to get regular listings. People had equity at that time, I think, in my area, which was primarily in the Diamond Bar area. I remember the homes were selling for about 180 or 200,000. And I think they ballooned up in about 2 or 3 years to just below in the twos, 250, 280, somewhere like that. So we had that explosive growth. And then it just shut off. The sales just shut off and the market just stopped. And then as the prices went down pretty fast from 91, 92 and 3, about a year into it, I realized, my gosh, and we didn't have short sales back then. These people aren't selling, a lot don't have equity, and all the way that I used to work just dried up and isn't working. And it was actually going out to, and at that time, I know our listeners that are maybe 20 years into real estate don't understand, but back 30 years ago, we had these silos for each individual MLS, and you didn't really, now you can work the world, we can see what's happening, and but before, if you weren't a member of that board and that board, you couldn't even really, your territories were very small. And so I was going out to look at somebody's property out in the Inland Empire, and I saw somebody sign up REO agent, and she worked in Chino. At that time, I worked in the City of Industry, I believe. And I thought, wow, REO, what is that? And I thought, well, she's in a different service area. Maybe I can talk with her. So I had a meeting with her. And since it wasn't a threat for her, and I was in entirely Eastern LA County, she was in the San Bernardino hub. And we sat down for a day, and I said, what do you mean you get your listings by fax and by FedEx and such, or UPS? And I said, wow. And by these asset managers. And I just took copious notes, Bruce. I really just wrote everything down that she told me. And I went back and just started cold calling these banks. I got the daily, I think it was a daily
default service,
Daily Commerce or Daily Journal, where it would show a few days later what reverted, and I could see what reverted. And I started calling, and I landed on one company that was called EMC, Mortgage Corporation, which was tied to Bear Stearns, which had thousands of listings in California through a company called Westfall. And somehow we got in, they would have you do a million BPOs, and after a while they'd throw you a bone. But we went through that, and after a while they liked our work. We really, really tried to do everything we could, the best we possibly could, and one by one by one. But I remember one time I cold called Wells Fargo, somehow got the asset manager, and then said, can I send you up a BPO? And I sent it up to him. And he said, oh, it's all the wrong form. And then I kind of started to argue with him. I said, what do you mean it's the wrong form? Time on it. How could that be? I was young and dumb. But somehow I realized, okay, I need to give him what he needs and serve him with whatever it is. And we did, and more and more and more. And it just started to where we became really immersed in working with the banks and really, really busy with them. And Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, did the multifamily for Freddie Mac. It was a lot. We did a lot, learned a lot in that 5 years, probably sold as much as some in their entire careers. So just learned a tremendous amount in valuations. And it was GE Capital that we got in with, which is also an extremely difficult account. And I'll never forget, it was one of their meetings. It was a Monday morning, showed up in Irvine, and my dad was always, if you're not half an hour early to work, you're late. And if you're not the last to leave, you left early. So aspiring to that, I was the first there at their 9 a.m. conference, maybe it was 8 a.m. And I was kind of new on the block for GE, but they had a lot of properties. And I'll never forget, I was the first to walk in the room, and they looked at me, and they said, we're going to make you really busy. Oh, that's great. That's great. And went back, and yes, they really did make me really busy. But the very first REO conference I went, this was probably 92 or 3 for REO Mac in Palm Springs. I had to borrow the money from my brother to go. And at that point, I'd only sold one REO, and it was for a third lender, I believe. He foreclosed on a property in Pomona. And I'll never forget, I got called by one of the asset managers from RFC, Residential Funding Corp, which is the jumbo loans, the Golden Goose account. And somehow I struck up conversation with him at the conference. And he said, well, Charles, yeah, maybe I could use you. Well, how many REOs have you sold? And I couldn't lie, and I had to think really quick. And I said, well, I could just tell you this. I have 100% track record. Every REO I've ever listed, I've sold. And so, yeah, it's been an amazing ride. I've flown around the country, met some amazing people. And yeah, it's been really, really a cool journey.
Well, what's interesting about what you just said is the transformation that buyers had to make for the first time as well. So like what you were saying, if you were door knocking people with equity, I was advertising to have them call me. And then in 1990 and 91, those conversations all changed. I felt like changed. I thought I was a counselor, you know. Mm-hmm. So what's your house worth? It's worth 150. I owe 170. And that was a crisis. The calls were double normal and everybody was in the same boat. So I remember thinking, well, maybe the business is over. In other words, the buying directly from people business has had its day. And then luckily I got a hold of an MLS and I opened it up and went, holy cow, they're sitting here. I mean, they were sitting there like at 40, 50% off on some of the stuff I wanted. And so I went, changed my whole game plan. And that really was the beginning of me thinking of the quadrant system, how we teach people, you know, when you have foreclosures that are escalating, your buyer hat changes from talking to people to talking to people like you that control inventory and short sale agents and so forth, to where it's repetitive business. You can rely, you know, we're not going to get a big percentage of what you do, but when one falls through the crack, you know, you can call the guy that's going to write the check and it'd be done with it. Well, that changed the whole dynamic. And then going to auctions, and I don't mean trustee sales, but I mean the physical auctions that HUD used to hold. So those, that 90 was just an interesting period of almost a re-education. And then of course that changes again after 97, 98, you didn't hear about REOs for a long time.
That's right.
And not in great numbers. Now, maybe you did because you had all the relationships, so you got the few that they had. But by and large, it didn't raise its head till what, 2008, something like that.
That's right. I remember distinctly when the market changed, because GE Capital used to have us do, while the property was through all the different stages, continually value it, and even an eviction. And it was in, I think it was around 1998, and we would always see that it had depreciated, and we would say whatever percentage, half a percent, or dropped 5,000 since last reporting period. And I'll never forget it. It was this eureka moment of, whoa, it's actually leveled off. Actually, this is upticked. We couldn't believe it. And actually, yeah, from that 6-year slide-ish, 6-year period-ish or so, and then it's wow. And then sure enough, from 98, and we did. We still had a little bit of REO up until about 2000 or 2001. And then those completely were gone. And from about maybe the end of 1999 to 2000 to 05, they were gone. They were gone.
Yep. But there was other opportunity. You just changed your hats and did something else.
We changed our hat. We did. I started working with the new home builders and tried to really entrench relationships with the builders using some of the same methodology that we would use for the banks and the valuation. And we're really experts at valuing these properties. So we let the builders know regarding their sales with the contingencies when the people have to sell their home and buy a new one. If they refer those people to us, we're going to make sure that that contingency doesn't get bogged down, that they're going to be represented right, that we're going to take good care of their people and help them get the most amount of equity so they can move into their new home. And we created this really cool reporting system, used some of the same systems we would report with valuation, and we could show a real quick snapshot of the real true value really pretty close. And it wouldn't be one overinflated. It was an honest opinion of really the value. And most of the time we were really, really on the mark on it. And then they could see, okay, here's their position. Yes, this is a good one. We were kind of like the pre-qualifier for the lender, for the builder, for their contingencies. And we did that really well. And then we also did really well by getting their listings as well.
Were you able to buy some of those homes, or did that wasn't really the intent?
Yeah, that really wasn't the intent. And it feels like kind of a conflict. So at that time, we ran two different businesses. We started buying at the trustee sale, and then we work with the builders at the same time. So from about 2000 to about 05, while we were running the builder program, we also were buying at the trustee sale. So we bought a tremendous amount at the trustee sale.
Which is interesting. So, okay, let's think about that. So as an REO agent, your business was sort of done at about 2000 as far as the volume, but the opportunity for the ones that had equity was still good. So you could become a buyer at a trustee sale.
Yes, there were still, at that point, they were not reducing like they did this last cycle where almost everything was underwater. The cycle before, they didn't really do reduced bids. It pretty much went out and you would just find, yeah, maybe maybe whatever went, it seemed like had equity because the values had come up. And so there was a lot going to sale, a lot would postpone, but I would say 90% of that got snatched, got purchased by the third party purchaser because it did have equity.
Thanks for joining us this week. That's going to do it for our interview with Charles Karich. Please tune in next week for part two.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.